Tonight is February 4th. This is the 11th lecture of the year. This is, again, our sixth year, 1300s. So what I would like to have done is, last week we were discussing Spanish Jewry. And basically we got through just about through the riots of 1391. We spent a lot of time going through the 13th century, the 1300s, 14th century, 1300s in Spain. So today I want to just complete that, because we didn't get a chance to talk about the aftermath of the riots, and then there's going to be another debate in the beginning of the 1400s. So if I were to just to very quickly recap, in 1212, this is what the map looked like. On top is Christian, bottom is Muslim, and then the Muslims in the beginning of the 1200s made one last run of it. And, you know, they got all their forces to try to retake Spain. And Spain got all their resources. This was the big, big, big fight. The fight was in, I forgot the name of this place, the Battle of, I don't remember where this was. But in 1212, there was a major, major battle, and they brought in all they brought in, you know, mission, they brought in knights, and they brought in people from, crusades from all over Europe to fight the Muslims, and that was it. After this battle, the Christians won, and the Muslims were never again a threat. By 1248, just about, we mentioned last time, just about all of Spain was under the... was under the Christians, except for a little bit part of Granada. That's going to remain that way till about 1492. That's going to remain that way for about 150 years. And as long as the Muslims were on the Iberian Peninsula, as long as they were here, the Jews had a place. But by this time now, the Jews, everything is starting to go downhill. The golden age of Spain is I guess, coming to an end. You probably have another till... probably have another 50-100 years. I mean, I guess that's, but it's slowly but surely coming to an end. Again, this is another same map. Okay, we also mentioned the highlights. I'm not going to go into it again. But in 1263, there was the first disputation. There was a debate against the Christians and the Jews. That, I guess, is sort of the beginning of being intolerant. Up until that time, you know, the Jews were Jews, and Christians had their religion, the Jews had their religion, everything is fine. But then the next level is, okay, you could do what you're doing, but just explain it to me. That's not, like, the same. And they called the Ramban in, but this debate was a fair debate, and it was so fair, and after 3 days, after the Ramban, who was the leader of the Jewish community, making the debate, was like wiping the floor with Pablo Christianity. So then they all decided, let's just stop it, because it's not going in the right direction that they wanted. And that was, again, in 1263. We start the 14th century, the 1300s, with about 120 communities, 100,000 Jews. Some gave this a little higher, a little bit more in the beginning of the 1300s. We mentioned just quickly the major events that affected Spain was the Black Death. It reached Spain also in 1348, probably more like 1349, 1350. It took a year or two. It was really 3 years, and all during the summer. During the winter, the plagues took a little bit of a break because of the cold. It didn't transmit as much. It didn't spread as much. Okay, we also had 1356. Again, we mentioned it was some sort of a revolt because Pedro of Castile, he was the king, and he appointed many Jews. Again, this is as precarious as it was. Spain was the most accepting of all the Christian countries of Jews, and one king goes ahead and he makes too many, and led to a riot, and eventually it led to a civil war, which... His brother, the next king, I think it was one of the King Henry's, killed his brother and had a new kingdom, but very shortly afterwards also hired many of the Jews who he his platform was get rid of the Jews out of the government. And when he became a Jew, and when he became king, he took many Jews back in. Okay, that was about 1356. So you see, 13, things are not as starting to go downhill for the Jews. What was the worst thing was the riots of 1391. Just very quickly, the king of Castile, John the First, died, and his son was only 11 years old. But at the same time, the Archbishop of Seville also died. So when you have the religious leader and the king both dying, and there's no real strong central government, so that led to the riots, and this is what we led to last time. It was, Jews always want stable governments, strong, stable governments, because whatever, throughout the Gullus, whatever rules you're going to present to us, we'll deal with. Just, it has to be rules, you want us to do this and not this, fine. Can't change the rules on us, just very arbitrary. But the Jews always managed to deal with, okay, you tell us what the set of rules is. You're going to allow us to do this? Fine, this is what we'll do. We can't do that? That's also fine. But just whatever your rules are, if you're promising us protection, so then we have to take the protection. You offer the protection, then you have to do good on your promise. It's when the government breaks down, and there are riots, and there are people, they have an open hand, that's when the Jews do not do well. Everything from the Crusades to when the Black Plague and there was a very weak central governments, and the riots of 1391 in Spain were the same way. We mentioned last time there was a preacher by the name of Martinez, Bernadette Martinez, and for many years he's been preaching from the pulpit against the Jews, and when in 1391, when the king died and the archbishop died, so then he took his people, and we mentioned last time in Seville itself, 23 shuls, he combined the Jews to the ghetto. He was also into breaking the contact between the Christians and the Jews, which eventually will be one of the main reasons for the expulsion of the Jews in Spain, because there would be so many converted Jews, and they felt that they're having a bad influence by the Jews that are still Jews. If you get rid of those Jews, then your converted Jews could become more Christian. Also, he held his thing was to remove Jews from position of power. So this is what all Martinez was. And sure enough, he started these riots, and it didn't stop. And it went from Seville, and it went to Cordova, and it went to... What was it? The Alicia, Jaén? How do you say it? Yahin, whatever, I don't know how to say, to Toledo, Aragon, and then into Aragon. This is all in Castile. Aragon was the next country over. So they didn't become together until Fernandez married Isabel. But they were different countries, so to speak, in Spain. Aragon had Valencia, Majorca, Barcelona, Girona, and other places in Catalonia. So this is all through, and it was like a one-two-year riot. It went from town to town, and the Jews were given a choice, and either they were killed, they convert, or they kill. And this is like the first time in Jewish history that Jews in mass converted. And we meant the numbers basically generally were along these lines: about 100,000 Jews converted. 100,000 Jews were murdered. 100,000 Jews somehow survived. I mean, this was just a total just disaster for the Jewish community. So we mentioned this. All we mentioned last time. Why again? Because what sparked things on is the Christian. That before the end of times, things are going to go crazy, and the Christians have such a thing. And when Jews are converting, so it just sparked them on. This is it. This is, we got to get more Jews, and this sparked on the riots. We also mentioned they also give different reasons that in Spain, even as early from the Visigoths, which is that even predated the Romans, The Visigoths were, when they turned, Visigoths were very good to the Jews until they became Christian. And then when they became Christian, depending on the king, they were very harsh on the Jews. But it was very periodic and they're very short term. And they would say to the Jews, you have to be Christian. So the Jews said, okay, and they may believe they were Christian. And after a few years, the Visigoths, they got tired of it. And then the Jews went back to becoming Jews. Also, in the Muslim world, which is not as, they don't have to do as much in the Christian world, and there may have been a few heterim from the Rambam, which is like the bottom one. So they thought, many, trying to figure out why did they do it, so many thought, listen, just like old times, you know, we'll ride this one out. You know, the Christians today, they're riots, tomorrow there'll be a king, and, you know, we'll be able to go back to becoming Jews. So that didn't happen. This time the Christians, they kept track, and they were strong, and they were not going to let the Jews backslide. But that's maybe why the Jews did it. They also, some did it because, you know, unfortunately they became comfortable. They had nice government positions. They were able to participate in the society. They were assimilated to a large degree. And that really led to the Jews to, led to the assimilation, led to becoming Christian. They also give reasons later, and this trend is going to continue. This trend of Jews converting, this is just the beginning of it. I think by the end of the next century, probably another 100,000 Jews are going to convert. There's Svarim, and the reasons given, they say, look, you know, once you become part of the secular society, and they gave other reasons, is that, you know, they weren't learning so well. They didn't take their Judaism so seriously. They also blamed a lot of it on philosophy. You know, they were still into the Aristotle and Greek philosophy. All these had a damaging effect on the Jews', you know, commitment to Judaism. Not hard for us to understand. We see this today. We see the more secular Jews are, the more assimilation is among them. All right, you said that just, 10, 20 years ago, the Federation came out with the map, right? And you see the Jews, how many Jews are in each one. And with the secular Jews, you have a whole bunch, and it comes down to like 2% are going to be in 20 or 30 years. And yet, when it comes to the religious Jews, you have a few, and just by the time, you know, in 20, 30 years, they project much, much more. I think the saying is that in like 20, 30, 50 years, there'll be less Jews eating matzahs, but more Jews eating shmur matzah. So, I mean, that's, you know, I don't know. It's funny, but it's sad. But that's the idea of it. They're going to have less Jews, but more of a from community, which is going to be its own set of challenges, because in terms of, let's say, fundraising, in terms of yeshivas, it really has been changing slowly. But 30, 40 years ago, many of the main supporters of the yeshivas, of the from institutions, religious institutions, were non-from people. You know, they grew up. The old generation grew up saying, okay, I'm not religious, but, you know, at least I'll support religious, and we know that that's the right way. It's just not for me. I didn't grow up that way, or it's hard for me. And they would support the yeshivas and religious institutions. There's been a shift in the next generation, and that shift is that, you know, who says that we should support the religious institutions? We have secular institutions, or maybe even non-Jewish institutions that we support, and they don't feel that same affinity to religious institutions. Well, in Spain, reasons that they gave was happening. They felt less Jewish. They weren't committed as much. Not to say that everybody was like that, but there were many in the society there. I read somewhere that it was more of the richer upper class society that was more involved with the non-Jews around them, as opposed to the poorer classes that were not involved in the government, that were more among the themselves. Maybe almost could be also a same type of a pattern, same type of similarity that we have today. Okay, so at the end, this is I think this is pretty much what where we were up to last week. I don't think I showed this slide. I think we're pretty much, we ended last week, just going through a little bit those riots. Today, I'd like to just continue because the aftermath, and mainly for the next 20 or so years, is going to be very hard for the Jews. The Christians are on the offensive, so to speak, and they have tremendous amount of momentum, and they see things are happening, and the Jews are, on the other hand, is a tremendous disheartening and tremendous like depression, like, what's going on? They look around and they see everything's falling apart. So you really had three categories of Jews. One, those who remain Jewish, like we mentioned in the slide before. Those who converted. But these are the, that's it, we're converting, that's it, new religion, new start, everything. But then you also had your Jews that just did it. You know, it's not for us to judge when a mob comes and they're ready to kill or rip you apart and, you know, we'd like to think that we'd be up to the challenge of remaining a Jew, but many of them said, "Okay, look, today it's crazy and there's mobs, and tomorrow we'll just go back." They weren't really serious about it; they just did it to save their lives. Even in the rest of the Europe, when there were situations like this, and Jews couldn't. It didn't happen as in mass, but the instances where Jews agreed to convert, the rabbis were very, very lenient on and allowing them to come back. All rabbinic literature, Shilas v'Tshuvas, they all say accept them back. Who are we to judge them at those times? So it's a hard. It was it's not for us to judge, but there were a sizable amount of Jews then there that were just, I guess, hoping for this all to blow over and for them to come back. Okay, again, what were they just in terms of, it was the Jews, I guess the percentage of Jews is about 120,000, which is about 2-4% of the total population, which was probably, give about 5 million Spaniards at the time. Am I off on my numbers? No, it would be probably about 5 million Spaniards. 120,000 were Jews, unconverted Jews. Some say it was a third of the Jews that converted. Some say it's even as much as a half. So this is what in 1391. This is what was coming into the 15th century. What happened to these Jews? Like now you have all these Jews. So this is it. This is emigration started. So it was very not hospitable. The Jews did not have that same cohesive, that same clout, you know, that they had before. So many of them started to leave. And then the question is where to go. Again, this is 1391. So many countries were blocked. There really weren't places to go. England expelled the Jews in 1291. France, 1306. So really, France and English, Western Europe, there was no really place to go. Even in Germany was the Jews were being expelled and also just very, very difficult for the Jews to be there as well. Germany was not like England, Spain, and France, because Germany, again, was still a whole bunch of little city countries. So you had like about 300 little municipal little areas. Some were greater, bigger than others. Some had like, I guess the Germany itself was a whole bunch together. But even still, it was not very, Germany was not hospitable. So where did they go? Where did they start to go? So they started, it was North Africa, the community at Constantinople. We're going to learn that around this time, the Turks are going to, I guess, in the middle of the 15th century, the Turks are going to conquer the Byzantine Empire, and they changed to Constantinople, and the Turks are going to just open up their arms. And if the Jews would be able to make it to the Turks, they'd have it made in the shade. They were very, very hospitable for the Jews. Poland is going to be is now starting to up and coming. Jews in from Germany, everything, the migration now is going east, and that's where another place into the Mediterranean basin, to even to Yerushalayim. That's pretty much where the Jews are. These Jews are going to be starting to head out. Okay, now they wake up the next day, or within a year, all of a sudden you have another 100,000 Jews. So I guess the church, I guess, was totally, totally unprepared for this. They didn't give Kiruv classes, Christianity 101. They didn't have these types of classes. So let's see what happened. So the mob came and they said to you, okay, you're Christian. So what happened next? Okay, what do I do now? You would imagine they never went to church, they had a mass, or they never did anything. They don't know what to do. So did they wake up the next morning and put on tefillin? The joke I'll leave out, but then now what do they do? How do they become Christian, or what's the next thing to do? So the church was not. They said, okay, you can't be Jews anymore because you gave your word, and if you go back to being Jews, that's heresy against the church, and it's treated differently than if you were always a Jew, which we're going to see. The Inquisition originally and mostly was for Christian, these Jews that became Christians that were backsliding to become Jews. The Inquisition, for the most part, was not for the Jews themselves. They were for the Jews who became Christians. That's it, you're one of us, you're going to go back, that's heresy, that's what the Inquisition is going to be for. So what do you do? What do they do? How do they know what to do, what not to do? And basically that was the, there's going to be a lot of mistrust from this point on, but the church was nowhere near prepared to deal with all these Jews and to integrate them and make them into a, make them full Christians. And that's going to lead to something that is going to be haunt these Christians, these Jews that from 1391 all the way till the expulsion, they're going to get a different name. They're going to be called New Christians for hundreds of years. I think even today, there's I'm not sure about today, but for many hundreds of years, there's the old Christians and the new Christians. And part of the reason was it was mistrust about the new Christians. It was just a little bit of jealousy because new Christians, now a new world was open to them, and there's going to be jealousy. So the new Christians were viewed like with suspicion. Why did you become Christian? You're not doing everything that you're supposed to be doing. I guess if you could imagine, all of a sudden you have tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of non-Jews becoming Jews. So what would they do? They'd come into the shuls, and what would they do? They would come to shul, they wouldn't come to shul, they would go to learn, they wouldn't learn, they'd come to the yeshivas, they wouldn't take things seriously, they wouldn't know what to do. So you'd view them like, what are you doing here? You're not a real Christian, or you're not a real Jew. And that's how they were viewed over here. There was a few names, they were looked down upon, these new Christians, and therefore they had to deal with they never had it good, these new Christians. It wasn't that for the most part they became Christians and that's it, life became easy for them. First of all, they were called new Christians, and then when they started coming into areas that they normally couldn't be, they were met with jealousy. And then they were always subject to the Inquisition. And when we talk about the Inquisition, we actually talked about it 2 years ago, but the Inquisition was really more of a money-making scheme. They constantly needed to find more people so they could get money. And that's really what it was. You take people, you torture them, you take all their money, and you torture them, they confess, and you kill them publicly, and you take their money. That was the Inquisition. And, okay, they had four names. these new Christians. First of all, they were called new Christians. They were also called conversos. And the secret Jews were called crypto Jews or secret Jews. They got a name Marano, right? I guess Christian Maranos mean like a pig. And then that's how they were looked down upon. In Jewish literature, in the Jewish Shaila V'Tshuvos, they were known as Anusim. Like the Anusim means Anus, Onis, being forced. These were the forced ones, innocent ones. And this is the way the rabbis called them. They're called Anusim. They were forced, you know. But this is what's going to happen now for the next 100 years. These they're going to be, they're going to sometimes backslide. They'll be looked on. They're not Jews, so the Jews are not saving their, they're not keeping their seat warm in shul. And the Christians are not like fully accepting them because so many at some time they just viewed it as with suspicion that they're not sincere. The king, on the other hand, yeah.
So the church never had any intention to really convert them, just to kill them.
No, they did. They just weren't prepared. They didn't, you know. I'm sure if they knew that this was going to happen, they would have, you know, they would have gotten themselves a school. They would have, you know, figured out, okay, what do we got to do? And they would have, like, you know, had Kiruv centers. I don't know. They would have done something. You know, like when they had to deal with heresy, right? Within the Christian church, many people had different ideas of what Christianity was, and the church didn't like that. So they created the Franciscan monks and the Dominican monks, and the purpose of these people were to know what the right, you know, the Torah Messinae, to know whatever they call it, you know, to know what the right laws were, and then to go around and teach the people the right laws, and if they're off, then deal with them. So here too, they probably would have been more effective in transitioning these Jews. But they weren't. They were caught off guard. The kings, on the other hand, they were very upset because this was for two reasons. First of all, whenever you have this riots and states of flux, it's not good for a kingdom. Kings, governments don't like riots. Riots are not good for business. Riots are not good for a stable government. That's A. And then it hits in the pocketbook. This is like it's taxes. The Jews were taxed, always taxed, much, much higher, a higher rate than the non-Jews. So now the kings, they're losing a lot of money, you know. Overnight you had 100,000 Jews that were paying, you know, three times the amount of taxes, and you just lost, like, you know, so much money overnight because they're becoming Christians. So on the one hand, the kings, they the temporal leaders, they didn't want the Jews to become Christians. They wanted them to stay Jews so they could get more, they can get more money out of them. So for those two reasons, they wanted stability, and they wanted more money. So it was not profitable for the kings, for the Jews to become Christian, until you get the kings, like Ferdinand and Isabel, that meant it. They thought, oh, that's their ticket to Olam Haba. They had a different mindset. Money just was not something that moved them. Okay. Then what happened is the next debacle, like a 1-2 punch for the Jews. So in 1413, there was a person by the name of Yeshua Lorki. He was a Jew. He was probably even a scholar. He was, and he went off, and he became a Christian, and he became a whatever you call a Christian monk. He became a priest. He became big in the Christian church. And he demanded, now he was again a big scholar, he knew Torah Shebiksav, he knew Gemara, he knew a lot of things. So he demanded that the Jews go ahead and have another debate. But they learned from the last debate from the Ramban, which we mentioned before in 1263, this is again about 150 years later, that, you know, they don't do well in a fair fight. You know, you have to stack your side with advantages, or you know, give them handicaps. So what they but this Yeshua Lurki there was an incident that happened with there was somebody named Shlomo Alevi, and this Shlomo Alevi, he was writing publicly that he went off And then this Yeshua Lurkey, he was told by his Rebbe to send letters to this Shlomo Alevi. This, again, Shlomo Alevi was a Jew, and he went off, and this Shlomo Alevi was writing things why you should become Christian. So one of the, I guess, Rishonim, one of the leading rabbis of the time, didn't want to write him directly, and went to a Yeshua Lurkey, and told Yeshua Lurkey, respond. And this is what you should respond. And Yeshua Lurkey was responding to this Shlomo Alevi. And it went back and forth. And then eventually what happened is Yeshua Lurkey converted. So the one who was, he converted. Now, some say that this is the same Yeshua Lurkey that he converted, and this is now the Yeshua Lurkey that's leading in the disputation against the Jews. And some say it was just totally different Yeshua Lurkey. So this is a person by the name of Yeshua Lurkey. I guess we'll see him on the next slide. As changed his name to a Spanish name. So what they did is they decided that they wanted to debate the Jews, and this time again it was started by Pope Benedict XIII. Now we mentioned last time about the popes, that during this time there was a split in the church, and this is called the Babylon captivity. Did I do this? Where? So I guess it's coming up. I guess when I do Italian Jews, we'll get into this. But at some point in the church, the Pope moved from Rome to Avignon in France, and they were there for quite a number of years. And eventually they moved back to Rome, but they picked a Roman Pope. The group that decided who becomes the Pope picked a Roman, but they felt the French representatives felt that they were being forced. Newsom, you know, so they afterwards when the mob left, they chose their own pope. So at a short time in history, for about 50 years, there were two popes going on. So after first it was only in France, and then they moved back to, for quite a number of years, and then they moved it back to Rome, and then there were, very shortly afterwards, there were two popes. One was in France, and one was in Rome. Now the pope in France was known as the anti-pope, because he was in France. Then after a whole bunch of years, they had a conference, and they brought two popes, and they fired them both, and they made a third, and they made a different pope. So the two that were fired they just kept going the way they were, and now they had three popes. So we'll probably get to it in a later lecture, maybe next week even. And then basically that didn't last too long, because afterwards they realized, okay, three popes, that's too much. And then they fired two of them, and they took one of them. Okay, in any case, and then it went back just to being in Rome. But at this point in time, there were two popes at the time. There was one in France, one in Rome. And the one in France, which was Benedict XIII, he was the one that was the sponsor. He was the one that was pushing this disputation, and they went ahead but this was more like, I guess they used the word of a pageant here. Let me just see if I have the next one. It was more like more of a showpiece. Nothing was ever fair. The Pope came, 70 cardinals. It could have been at some point 2,000 Christians watching this, and then they took Jews. They forced Jews from all over. Castile and Aragon mainly, to come down and represent. And they did a lot of things that were not, things that were really not fair. One thing is Yeshua Lurkey, Geronimo? Is that how you say the name? Geronimo de Santa Fe, that was the name that Yeshua Lurkey took on. And they started in 1412. And It was over 20 months, 69 sessions. The Pope, that Pope was there, but it was not a fair debate. It was, the Jews were never allowed to say anything negative against the Christian church. And they were warned. They said, if you say anything against the Christian church, we will kill you. And you're talking to people that had the ability and had the will to go ahead and kill. So now you have the Rabbanim there. We're just afraid. What do you say? Combine that with, they had a whole bunch of Jews there, and they wouldn't allow the Jews often to coordinate their answers. So you'd hear one person would say one thing, and then another Jew would say something else. And you see, you're contradicting. At some point, this Yeshua Lorki said that they should be killed because of heresy against their own religion. You know, like that's to that point. They had, the leaders over here of that debate were Zechariah Levi, Astrup Halevi, Yosef Albo, and Matthias Matisyahu Zahari. These were the main four of the of this disputation. Yeshua Halorki would present them with Midrashim, and he'd say, okay, explain. And they would say, we never saw such a medrash. Where are you getting this from? And Yeshua Lucky would say, sorry, I'm not telling you where he got it from. So they were accusing Yeshua Halorki of making up midrashim that the Jews had to respond to. So you couldn't see the source of the medrash. They couldn't respond. They were hit with threats. And it was just about, and it kept going on. At some point, okay, and they and this is what the debate looked like. Plus, you had hundreds and thousands of Christians all watching this. The Pope himself would say things. Not only that, but after hours, the Jews were bothered. At the end of the day, they went and knocked on their doors, and they wouldn't be allowed to prepare. And it was very demoralizing. Many Jews started to convert all during this process. Okay, so I guess the Christians had a different idea of what this purpose was. The purpose really was to convert the Jews. They weren't really interested in a fair debate. They just wanted to prove the weakness of the Jew and to try to get them to fall in. And to the arguments presented by the Jews, he retorted by accusing them of heresy against their own religion, is what I said. You're going against your own religion, we'll kill you for that. You know, that your own religion won't kill you, we'll kill you. Okay. Yeah, many of them were total in shock. You can't, how do you prepare? How do you debate somebody when you have all these pressures? Plus the fact now it's dragging on. So you have people away from their homes for over a year. What happened is that the last word was always given to Yeshua Lorki, Geronimo. He was always had the last word, so it always looked like he had what to say. It was broken down into two parts. The first part was to talk about what was Mashiach, okay? As in the Rambans, you know. Let's talk about Mashiach. What is Mashiach? How could they would probably quote a few. Passages in the Gemara and Midrashim that talk about what Mashiach is, but based on those passages, you know, why you have a hard time explaining what your Mashiach is and why is our Mashiach wrong. That was part one. Then there was part two. Hold on. Part one. Now, they were also asked, Yeshua Lorki sent them a question. He had a book that he made. But he sent them 12 questions on the subject of Yashka, original sin, causes of exile. And they once you had the questions, so they were able to respond to the questions by writing. At some point, they actually had the debate in writing. At some point, maybe they were referring to this part, but they answered these debate. These questions were answered with some of the best answers. When they were able to get themselves together, and they were able to think, and they were able to respond in a coordinate way, coordinating while they were coordinated, They were, came up with tremendous, tremendous answers. And we have these books. There are three books that came out as a result of this. And when it came to the second part, most of the Jews, they said, we had enough. We want to go home. So when the they said they would have to go home, and they wouldn't let them. They said, look, we have it's too hard for us. We're away from our communities. And Jews saw what was going on, and they started converting because they saw the Christians were always getting the last word. And eventually, so again, the main three, Zechariah Halevi and the other two, they ended up, Matasiel Yitzri, Astrak Halevi, they ended up staying to the end. So Zechariah Halevi was there. He was always refuting the he refuted the arguments. Rav Astrak tried to point out, like, you're trying to have a debate, but it's really not fair. Totally unjustified. I mean, it's the, I guess when you have to know who you're talking to, it's very daring to say such a thing. And Yeshua Lorki, he was just content against the Medrash and the Talmud, and they actually wanted to, like, say, have another burning or have a censorship of Talmud and Medrash. When the second part, the Jews had enough. And they kept asking questions, and all the Jews remained silent. And they said, you can't prove anything from us. We're not on that level. We're too weak, and we can't answer properly the words of the Talmud. And it was just like, I guess at some point, they realized that the Jews had enough, and they weren't answering. They weren't playing the game anymore. So eventually, shortly after that, most of them were all sent home. November 12th, that's it, they concluded, that's it, the debate was over, if you can call it a debate. What happened, what was the, many, many Jews converted, and while this was happening, the persecution against the Jews was there. They actually wanted to, take things out of the Gemara because it spoke against Christianity. It was this was, again, while this was going on, it was an incentive against the Jews, and many Jews converted, all as a result of this. Sometimes even some of the participants converted. And once they converted, they brought them over to you and said, okay, now you're helping us against the Jews. I mean, to that point. These are the three books that came out. First, Sefer Ikrim. This is by Rav Yosef Alber, and he clarified the religious fundamentals, Sefer Ikrim, Ikrim, of what we believe in. Or for Sefer Hamunot, from Rav Shem Tov, regarded in terms of philosophy, cause of conversion. And the last was Igeres HaMusar, by Rav Shlomo Alami. His Igeres HaMusar was, like, why are we in this situation? And it's because the Jews showed a lack of care, a lack of respect to their own religion, and this is why this is all happening. So these are the three books that came out of from this. We have the Sefer Ikrim today. I think I have one in my home today. Sefer Ikrim is a book even today that people have. Sefer Munat I'm not familiar with, but it could be around today as well. 1420, 1416. Actually, I forgot. I didn't get a chance to put it on the slide. But a lot of things happened in 1416. In 1416, I believe it was Pope Benedict died, and Yeshua Lorki, the king, died. And once that happened, all of the things that were in place to go after the Jews fell apart. So I guess it's the chesed of Hashem that in 1416, their power base. I'm not sure if it was Pope Benedict died or around 1416 that the popes in Avignon lost their job. So I'm not sure either one of the two happened. So that took a lot of momentum away from the Christians. And the king died, so the king that was sponsoring this also died. And then the Jews got a break, big break. So the focus on the unconverted Jews had stopped. It was like lessened. And from this point on, from like 1416, 1420 on, until the expulsion 70 years, 80 years later, not going to be about the converted Jews. Now everything really is going to start to turn their attention to the converted Jews, all the Jews that became Christian. Okay? Okay, so now, again, these new Christians, now you're treating us as Christians, so very good. So now they can, all of a sudden, applications to all the medical colleges opened up, and now you had all these Jews applying to become doctors. Many positions in government that were not available to Jews now opened up for Jews. And you have to, I guess you could imagine the Christians that were already there, the last thing they wanted were a whole bunch of Jews coming in and taking over their positions. Either new Christians now, but that's maybe not the way they saw them. They saw it as, you know, these are why he became Christian, so he could take my job, so he can advance his career. And that led them to be called new Christians, which actually broke out in one or two rebellions. One was in 1449, a rebellion broke out in Toledo against the king, and when the king was, you know, sending out his tax collectors, who now were the new Christians, so they were set upon, they were killed. Again, waves of anti-violence, 1467, and again in 1475. These were all against the converted Jews. The focus now was on the Jews that were converted. Are they serious? Among them, there probably were a tremendous amount of Muranos, those that were practicing secretly, maybe those that didn't even know better and just did it because that's where they always did it. But that's where the focus was now on. And now we're coming close, very close to 1492. And this is what's going to set everything at the end in 1469. Isabella, who would become the ruler of Castile in 1474, married her cousin Fernadette of Aragon. This was done by, there were Jews that were the Shatranim on this. You know, I guess they felt it would be better for the Jewish community, and they were the ones that pushed the Shidduch. And after they were married, they lobbied Pope Paul II to establish an Inquisition in Castile, but the Inquisition should be under the control of the king. So Pope Paul said, no, not interested, we don't want to do it. But that was only until he died. He died shortly afterwards. New Pope Sexton, I think, is that how you say it? Sixtus the Fourth. He became the new pope. And he was then being threatened. The papal states were being threatened by the Turks. So Isabel and Fernadette, mainly Fernadette, who was the king of Aragon, basically said to the pope, if you want my support to help you against the Turks, then agreed to the having an Inquisition in Spain, which he did. So now you had the Inquisition set up in Spain in about 1475, 1478 was the Inquisition. And the Inquisition was just horrid. I mean, unspeakable. I'm not going to just go through anything that they did, but there was the concept of the Inquisition came already in the 12th century, in the 1100s, and that was when there was what they would call heresy, things that the people were saying that they didn't believe in, so they made an Inquisition to get people back in line. But there was nothing against the Jews. Here now they wanted to use it against these Jews that were the new Christians. They give you a grace period, then you have to come forth with evidence, and of course, when they came forth with evidence, the person who was being accused never saw the evidence. He never knew. They wouldn't tell him who told on them and all the full evidence is. They were just being accused. And, I'm sorry. They were arrested, tortured, and guilty parties remained unrepentant, giving authorities for execution. And that was then that led to an order de fa, and publicly they would be killed. It's like an amazing, you know, Sunday afternoon, instead of going to the Super Bowl, you would go to the public square where they were burning people, Christians that were suspected or actually really being secret Jews. And that's what from this point on in Spain. I think the Inquisition was officially ended in the early 1800s or late 1700s in Spain, but for sure it was in South America where it continued until the mid early 1800s. To that effect, that's what this kept going. It was supposed to stop Jews. The purpose is to stop the Jews from becoming back to Jews, but it had a very it really was counterproductive, because any Jew at this point that would consider converting also had to know that there was an Inquisition, that if he was suspected of becoming a Jew or staying a Jew, he would be killed, tortured. So at the Inquisition probably was more effective keeping Jews from converting and keeping them as Jews rather than, you know, than it did have that effect. And it was just unbespeakable, the tortures that they thought of and everything. And they, you know, just like, we're looking back, we don't understand, how is it, how, just you don't think that if you took a person and you torture them, you get them to say anything that they want, that you want them to say? But that was enough for them to kill them and then to take all their money. But again, it was, and again, that was one of the main things of the Inquisition, is to take themselves, to get themselves money. We have such a difference in the Torah. We have something called an Ir Nidachas. What's an Ir Nidachas? Where you have a town that's, most of the town is worshiping idols. And the Torah just explains many, many things about that town. First of all, it brings, like, you need about four or five different chakiras, checkings. You have to make sure 100%, and you get the witnesses, and you'd have to cross-examine the witnesses to make sure that all these people that are in the city are doing Avodah Zarah. And they know that they're doing Avodah Zarah, and they're doing Avodah Zarah. And then it says you kill the people, and you're not allowed to take from any of the spoils. Anything in the city has to be burnt and destroyed. And the city itself cannot be rebuilt. So once you take the monetary motive, incentive out of it, then why would you, you know, like, of course you would not want to do the, you know, you're only doing it because the Torah says to do it. But here, this wasn't yet. Okay, what would then they realize is, why were many, they figured, and it was probably true to a large degree, is why were many of these Jews continuing to be Muranos or secretly Jews, is that there was an influence on the Jews. You could have in one family, like brothers and sisters, some converted and some didn't. I don't think there was a law that they couldn't eat at the same house. So it was known that these two siblings were Christians, and these two siblings were Jews, and they'd be eating at the same meal. You know, I mean, it definitely could have happened. You know, when the mobs came around and they found two of the brothers, two of the siblings, and not the others, so they converted, and the others didn't. So now you had within families, you had situations where some were Jews and some were Christians, and the church realized that this was a bad influence. They had to get rid of the Jews. As long as the Muslims, I guess, were on the peninsula, the Jews were relatively safe. Once the Jews were sent out, once the Muslims were finally attacked, and when Ferdinand Isabel became king, one of the things they did is they sent the army, and finally the Muslims were exiled, or they lost the war and they went to North Africa. Then they turned their attention to the Jews. They told the Muslims, you have a choice, convert or leave. And then they turned their attention to the Jews, and they made them the same choice, convert or leave. And it was the famous Barbanel, who was the finance minister of Ferdinand Isabel. He tried his best to stop to stay the decree, but he was not able to. The number of exiles was between 100,000 and 150,000. Most went to Portugal. And 5 years later, in 1497, they are going, most of those are going to be forcibly converted. And I think that'll probably be for another lecture, because this really is taking us to the end of the 14th century. Today we're mainly dealing with the Bay of Tortosa, which is 1413, 1416. And I think I have over here the Barbanel, attempted to have the decree annulled, but he was not able to. He originally went to Portugal and then ended up in Italy. And okay, so that's going to be the end of Spanish Jewry. It was the hardest on them. This was the worst of all the expulsions. First of all, it was the worst because it was the largest in terms of numbers. Whenever there was expulsions, so the expulsions were never in this amount of Jews. It was also final expulsion from Jews from Europe. Again, this after Great Britain, after England, France, now Spain, and many places in Germany. This would probably end Western Europe. Western Germany, Western Europe. Spanish community has been the oldest, wealthiest, most established, and that was gone. Just it finished. After many years, the Jews were there. They predated the Romans, and they were there for probably close to 1,000 years there. And the Golden Ages was when the Muslims took over and set in the early 700s, and the Golden Age would probably have been for 500 years, from the 700s to the 1200s. The last 200 years was on its way down. And that's going to be the end of Spanish expulsions. I'd like to next week go to Italy and start off from the Jews from Italy and get all the way up into the at least the 1300s, maybe beyond. Also, I guess talk about the popes, the different Babylon captivity, the popes moving, and what effect it had on the Jews as well. Okay, any questions? Okay,
thank you. Columbus Jewish?
Great question. All his backers were Muranos. All his backers were Jews, mainly Muranos. So there's a very good chance that he was a Jew. He for sure had Muranos on his boat. So that's the reason why he was suspected, or they said he was Jew for a few reasons. One, all his backers were Muranos. In other words, he was in that group of people. So there's a very strong reason to suspect if he hung out with Muranos, then if his backers were Muranos, then it's a good chance he himself was as well. Also, he left his journey started to the New World on Tisha B'Av of 1492. He writes in his diary he couldn't get out of the harbor because of the tens of thousands, of hundreds of thousands of Jews leaving that day on the boats. He just couldn't get out. The traffic was tremendous. Again, that's, I guess, Hashem's irony. In the day that the Jews were being exiled from Spain is the day that Columbus set sail to start the new, to discover the new world, where eventually it will be where the Jews would find haven much later.